From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Paul Ryan is standing by House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes. Ryan said today that Nunes does not need to recuse himself from the committee's investigation of Russian election interference, despite growing questions about Nunes's independence. Meanwhile, this morning, House Republicans met for the first time since they failed last Friday to muster the votes needed to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Paul Ryan described the meeting as honest and constructive.
I don't want us to become a factionalized majority. I want us to become a unified majority. And that means we're going to sit down and talk things out until we get there. And that's exactly what we're doing. And we saw good overtures from those members from different parts of our conference to get there, because we all share these goals and we're just going to have to figure out how to get it done. Thank you.
Speaker, Mr. Speaker.
So lots to talk about with Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
And let's start with Devin Nunes. He's been criticized for visiting White House grounds a day before going to the president with information that members of Trump's team were caught up in incidental surveillance by U.S. intelligence officers. His critics say he's too close to the White House to be impartial. What kind of pressure is he under at this point to recuse himself?
The kind of pressure that comes from a lot of different directions at once. You know, you've got Democrats who see him, as you say, not as the lead investigator for this whole probe, but rather as the Trump administration's de facto defense attorney with respect to the investigation. And you've even got, secondly, some Republicans joining in that kind of doubt, not in the House, perhaps, but several senators, perhaps the usual suspects you would expect, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Susan Collins, all saying he ought to recuse himself. And then third, from the media, because there are so many questions, obvious questions that he won't answer. And he had almost an impromptu news conference today walking through a tunnel in the Capitol, right, between his office building and the Capitol itself, with five or six reporters firing questions at him, and he wasn't answering any of them. And then finally, the pressure from the public, not only the watchdog groups, but also polls that show people think even the appearance of his conflict of interest would be enough for him to recuse himself.
But his response in that hallway underneath the Capitol was basically, why would I do that?
Well, he would do it for all the reasons that have been stated. And of course, he's aware of that. And he's just shrugging his shoulders and trying to play innocent.
Well, today, the Washington Post is reporting that the Trump administration tried to block the former acting attorney general Sally Yates, that's the one who Trump fired, from testifying in the committee's investigation. What's going on there?
Quite a bit seems to be going on there. The Department of Justice finally said, look, you're going to have to work this out with the White House attorneys and your own attorneys to decide what would be covered by confidentiality, what you would have to refuse to answer because of what it might reveal about what you know in terms of investigative sources and techniques and things of that nature. Certainly, Sally Yates would have understood that, but there's a sensitivity around what else she might have been asked about and what else she might have testified about, which could include, for example, the direction of the investigation, the sort of general overall targets of the investigation, which she might well have known even as the acting attorney general, because after all, the FBI is part of the Department of Justice.
But doesn't the White House risk looking like it is trying to hide facts here?
It does indeed, because you have their efforts, apparently, to provide certain kinds of information to Devin Nunes. And then you also have their apparent, or reported by the Washington Post, effort to silence Sally Yates or keep her away from this particular hearing. Right. And as we do know, this much we do know for sure, there was going to be a hearing and an open hearing today, and the House Intelligence Committee canceled,
right,
that hearing. And the speculation is they canceled it because they hadn't figured out what to do about Sally Yates.
Ron, we saw the demise of the health care bill, the Republican health care bill, last Friday. But now it seems like some are making statements that they do want to continue to pursue a repeal and replace of Obamacare. The majority whip, Steve Scalise, said Republicans are closer than ever to repealing and replacing a law. Have they not moved on?
They have not moved on in the sense of feeling an obligation to what has been their central theme and issue for the last 7 years. They're certainly aware of that. They know what a beating they've taken over it. Steve Scalise, of course, is the chief vote counter and pitch man, so he is obviously going to try to put a good face on this. But the bill they voted on, or did not vote on, a week ago, last week, was that is dead. that particular piece of legislation is not coming back. But the interest in doing something to repeal Obamacare and replace it, that's going to be with the Republican Party for as long as they're the majority in the House and Senate and as long as they have President Trump in office.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, in a report issued today, Amnesty International concludes that the recent spike in civilian casualties in Mosul in Iraq suggests the U.S.-led coalition is not taking adequate precautions to protect civilians in its joint effort to defeat ISIS. The report followed the March 17th airstrike that killed more than 100 civilians in Mosul. The U.S. military has acknowledged carrying out that strike, but said it's investigating fatalities. This spike is raising the question, has there been a shift in strategy by President Trump, taking the gloves off, so to speak, after he promised to do so, to bomb the blank out of extremists during the campaign? Here's Trump on the campaign trail in 2015.
Somebody criticized me the other day because they asked me what I do, and I said, I'm going to bomb the out of them. It's true. I don't care. I don't care. They've got to be stopped.
And a couple of months later, in another interview on Fox and Friends, Trump said President Obama had been politically correct and that with the terrorists, you have to take out their families. Kevin Barron is executive editor of Defense One. He joins us now from Washington. Kevin, first of all, let's be clear. These strikes are the U.S. I mean, these are strikes that we are not just calling in, but we are doing.
That's right. There is a war going on. Let's let the public forget.
Right. Right, right. And there are Iraqi troops on the ground. You were at a briefing today with General Stephen Townsend, the current commander of Combined Joint Task Force. What did he say?
So General Townsend today gave a pretty remarkable, lengthy interview via phone from Baghdad here at the Pentagon, where he explained as much as they can in these kind of situations. And the bottom line is that he's saying it looks quite possible that the American strike did cause this building collapse, but that it's likely a combination of factors with ISIS, meaning that there's evidence that there was some sort of IED or very big IED, a VBID. And as well, the big question of why civilians were there in the first place. And the general said from the U.S. perspective, there's no reason that a civilian should have been at that location unless they were forced to be there. So he took a lot of pains to try to shift a lot of blame for the ground war, the situation going on there, all in ISIS, but said in this case, there were U.S. airstrikes in that area. What they're trying to find out is that did this specific building, these locations, was the tragedy the cause of the U.S. airstrike or some combination thereof?
We want to take that up, the idea of were they forced to be there. But first, just to be clear, it sounds as if he's not saying there's been a change in the rules of engagement, that there are fewer restrictions.
Not exactly true. So The way that he just put it today was that, the first years of this war, 2014-15 and into last year, 2016, it was a defensive battle. As the war progressed and the U.S. coalition started to push back and retake territory, heading north and all the way up into Syria, that they needed a more offensive stance and more offensive rules of engagement. And those changes were made, he said today, but they came at a much lower level. They had to be approved by the Central Command, U.S. Central Command, basically General Votel, the war room in Tampa. They did not go up to the Secretary of Defense. They did not go up to the White House. So from his perspective today, It's not true to say that Donald Trump's authorization to loosen rules therefore ended up in more civilian casualties and strikes. And frankly, as a veteran reporter of this beat and these wars, that makes quite good sense.
He didn't say we have new rules of engagement post-President Trump. He did not say that.
Right. So it's a little too, I think, convenient for critics who want to find something to attack Trump. To say, aha, he came to power, he said he loosens things, and now we have these new engagements. Another reason for the civilian casualties that the general reminded everyone of, in his perspective, is that the war has now shifted to a new area, Western Mosul, which is incredibly much more dense. It's the older part of the city. The Pentagon has been saying for a long time there will be more casualties there, it will be a harder fight, and for any civilians who are caught there, it's going to be trouble. And that's also part of his reasoning for why this has happened.
Well, very briefly, Arwa Damon of CNN, who has been stunningly brave. She's standing on the bombed-out streets of Mosul today. Other reporters are there as well. But she told us on her last trip how ISIS did take over a house and made the people living there stay there, and many of them were killed when the coalition hit that house with an airstrike.
That's right. And in this case, there's some early reporting and evidence that families were moved specifically to this location. Again, if you were in Mosul by now, you're trapped there. Mosul has been encircled for some time, weeks, if not months. Even if you tried to get out on the easier side from the east earlier on, families were just being picked off by snipers and IEDs. It's you know, like in every other campaign in Iraq, when the coalition moved into the area, they found people trapped and surrounded by booby traps and tunnels and snipers, and that's why it's taking longer than people may have wanted or anticipated. Right. But from the military's perspective, it's taking just as long as they need to be as deliberate and cautious as possible.
Right. It's a terrible story. Thanks for weighing in on it, Kevin Barron of Defense One.
According to a recent Gallup poll, there's been a sharp increase in daily worry since the presidential election. There was also an uptick in worry after Barack Obama was elected in 2008, but not nearly as much. Still, change tends to make people worry more. But is worrying useful? And what can be done if we're worrying too much? Joining us now is Michelle Newman, a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Penn State University. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And everybody worries about some things at some times. But what is worry and why do we do it?
So worry is anticipation of threat. Usually it's about the future. And we often do it to prepare for the worst possible outcome or to motivate ourselves. Those are the two most common reasons why people say they worry.
Is it innate?
I would not say it's innate. I would say anticipation of threat is innate as a protective mechanism. But in terms of worry itself, which is a little bit different than just anticipation of threat, because it's that perseverative process where you're sort of repeating a lot of the same material over and over again and working yourself up, that part isn't necessarily innate because it doesn't really help you.
Is there good worry and bad worry?
Regular anticipation of threat, obviously, is good. And you know, just generally thinking about the future and preparing for the future is good. But when it becomes not good is when it is chronic, when you're doing it a lot and it feels more uncontrollable. Meaning once you've started and really gotten into it, you're having difficulty stopping yourself.
Well, how do you know when you have crossed that line and gotten to the point where it's dangerous for you?
It's typically when you've been worrying most of the day, nearly every day, for at least 6 months. That's when you might meet the criteria for generalized anxiety disorder.
Are there certain people who are more susceptible to worrying than others? And I'm not talking about to the point where they are, you know, worrying every day, all day for 6 months, but just they worry more in general.
There are, but the way that we view it is that it's a bad habit, that people get into the habit of worrying and they actually often feel like, to some extent, it helps them. So they keep doing it.
Now, what about the saying, worried sick? Can worrying cause you to actually get physically sick?
Yes. If you're worrying chronically, there is data to show that worry is associated with future coronary heart disease problems. And there's psychoneuroimmunology data showing that it can suppress the immune system.
So what do you tell people about how they can avoid worrying when it's not necessary for survival?
Well, there are several things that you can do. One of them is to know what sorts of things trigger your worry. So begin to identify the types of things that tend to lead you to worry. And then the minute you encounter that trigger, to try to relax, let it go, cut it off, then, as opposed to waiting until it gets really intense.
A recent Gallup poll shows that daily worrying has increased among Americans since the election last year. Do big changes like that or uncertainty typically cause people to worry more?
Yes. And there is some data to suggest an association between people who tend to worry chronically and people who have particular difficulty with uncertainty.
Have you noticed an increase in people's anxiety levels?
Anecdotally, yes.
Hmm. And what do you tell them?
You know, the same things I would tell them, you know, in any other circumstance where the worry wasn't really helping them and just stressing them out, which would be, you know, there are several intervention techniques that work really well. One of them is simply relaxation. Various relaxation or meditation techniques can be really helpful.
Exercise?
Exercise is great, yes.
And sleep, I assume.
Well, sleep is great, but people who tend to worry chronically often begin to worry more right when they are trying to fall asleep. So it is good to engage in behaviors that are good for sleep hygiene. And those would include things like if you notice yourself worrying, leave the bed, go somewhere else. Try to read or relax before getting back into bed so the bed isn't associated with worry.
Hmm. And just a change of scenery, it sounds like, also helps.
Yes. Being in the moment, trying as much as possible to enjoy the moment and be present is also good.
Does writing down your worries help?
No. I mean, it helps to know what the things are that tend to trigger your worries and write that down. But actually writing out your worries or talking out your worries is pretty much the same as worrying.
So don't do it.
Yeah, it exacerbates the problem. It makes you more worried.
Well, Michelle Newman, any other advice you have for the worriers out there?
No, I mean, understand that ultimately worrying, for the most part, doesn't really help. And trying to cut it off early, those are the two best pieces of advice I can give you.
That's Michelle Newman, who's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Penn State University. Michelle, thank you.
Sure.
Well, early this morning, entrepreneur Elon Musk tweeted about a new company he's starting. It's called Neuralink. Musk said there will be more details in about a week. But the company would reportedly use technology to implant electrodes in our brains to connect us to computers. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She joins us from New York. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And this idea sounds like it's straight out of a Michael Crichton book. I'm thinking now Westworld, come to life. How would this work?
Not to get too comic book guy on you, but it's actually the plot of Mass Effect Andromeda.
Okay.
I learned that from Twitter. So anyway, so what this would do, according to Elon, is add another layer of intelligence to your brain. He's like, you have the limbic system, you have the cortex, and then this would kind of be a digital layer over that would allow you to connect to technology faster. It would kind of supercharge your brain, almost like Mario after he eats one of those mushrooms.
Hmm. And what would the applications be? What would you be using this for?
I'm assuming that it means using technology faster. Elon talked about how slow we are when we use our thumbs with our phones. It would allow us to connect directly to technology instead of having to use our appendages. It's like an ultimate sync to the internet and to artificial intelligence.
Is the technology there for this?
That's unclear. I mean, you have to remember that Elon is all about moonshots. He's hiring some of the best minds in the field to figure out exactly how to get this done. He's saying that he can get it done possibly without having to do any kind of invasive surgery. It would just be something that you would connect to the back of your head or something like that, that would give you this supercharged semi-robotic ability.
Hmm. Now, Elon Musk is currently CEO of Tesla and SpaceX. He's also the guy behind Hyperloop, which, amazing idea. I still haven't seen anybody take one yet.
And don't forget that Tesla bought SolarCity, which was the residential solar energy company that his cousin helmed and went almost into bankruptcy. Unless Tesla had bought it, it would be no more. And so not only is Elon managing Tesla, he's managing SolarCity within that, which is $700 million worth of whatever every quarter. So he has a lot on his plate. You know, people clown him for this all the time, but there was a $1,000 deposit that people put down for his Model 3, which is supposed to be the mid-priced $35,000 sedan that Tesla is supposed to roll out. People haven't heard about that money in about 317 days. So it's unclear. Everything is happening very slowly in the world of Elon Musk. And it sounds like there are more big money-raising ideas coming out of it than actual product.
So we may not have a wire connected to the back of our head anytime soon.
No. No, I don't think so.
Okay. And are other companies working on this same kind of idea?
You know, I think that the Wall Street Journal mentioned that Facebook is putting out some feelers for experts to delve into this for them. But in terms of this big idea of, you know, creating another consciousness for humans that's also robotic, no one really comes at it like Elon Musk. And people are – if they are doing it, they're doing it secretly. Elon is a huge showman. This is how he raises money. This is how he gets people excited about his products. So not only is he talking about, you know, enhancing the human existence, but he's – speaking to this sci-fi notion of the singularity, you know, when humans surpass biology and become semi-robotic because we have to survive the robot apocalypse before they become too intelligent and take us out. I mean, this is some pretty futuristic stuff.
That's Lynette Lopez, who is a senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Lynette, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag Trypod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
And what happens now that the state of Michigan has agreed to pay $87 million to the city of Flint to settle a lawsuit and to replace 18,000 lead-tainted water lines over 3 years? In 2014, Michigan officials switched the drinking water from Detroit to the Flint River without treating the corrosive Flint water, which soon began leaching lead from the pipes. Residents became sick. Children are still poisoned. And while the water was switched back, the problems remain in the pipes, which a lawsuit by justice and environmental groups and one resident argued was a violation of the federal Safe Drinking Water Act. Well, they've won. Harold Harrington is with Local 370 of the United Association of Plumbers and Pipe Fitters. And Harold, we met you last year there in Flint, where your team was changing water filters. You say now, first you think there are many more homes that should have lines from the street changed, but also there might be other sources of lead?
Right now, they're replacing the galvanized and the lead lines. They're replacing both of those service lines that are coming into the houses in Flint. They're not addressing anything inside the homes that have been damaged. There's a lot of homes in Flint built before 1960. Most of them have galvanized lines. If they haven't been replaced over the years, they still have galvanized lines inside the houses.
Well, and there's a new study from Virginia Tech professor Mark Edwards that backs up your thinking. This is the man that unearthed much of this problem to begin with. And he says that there's been a destabilization of lead-bearing corrosion rust layers that accumulated over decades on the galvanized iron pipes in the interior of the house. Why hasn't this been more of a conversation?
Well, it has been a conversation locally. You know, I've been letting people know because there's been people coming into town selling whole house filters, okay? That would be good, keeping anything from the street coming into your house to contaminate it. But a whole house filter does nothing downstream inside your house. And if you've got galvanized pipes in your house, you're still subject to get lead poisoning unless you have a point-of-use filter. Now, the point-of-use filters is what the state has been supplying. They go right on the faucet.
That's what we saw your members putting on when we visited.
Yeah, we put thousands of those on for Flint residents, and right now they have Flint residents going around making sure they're installed properly and giving cartridges out to the residents that need new cartridges.
We got to wonder why this wasn't part of the suit. But meantime, the message to Flint residents, I would think, is even if you're getting the surface line up to the house replaced, you have to think about wall in as well.
Yeah, and when we were going around with the DEQ last year, we were identifying what types of pipes were actually in the houses for the DEQ. So, you know, they have some of that information out there. I don't know what they're doing with it right now, but that's why Flint residents still need to be careful on the lead. It's the particulate lead. That's what they're finding, and that's what Mark Edwards said in his study. That is the big issue right now, and it will be for the foreseeable future.
That's Harold Harrington with Local 370 of the United Association of Plumbers and Pipefitters. Harold, thank you.
Well, thanks for calling.
And best of luck. And by the way, when we first met Harold last year in Flint, he told us he hoped that at least there might be an upside to this terrible story and that more Flint residents might be interested in becoming plumbers who've become kind of heroes there in Flint. Well, today he told us, in fact, many have applied. His union has accepted 6 residents into their apprenticeship program. And he said that with the pipe replacement, which he, as you heard, thinks is imperfect, at least there will be more jobs on the horizon. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org. One small comfort, here and now.
It's actually happening tomorrow. British Prime Minister Theresa May is going to trigger Article 50 and officially start the process of Britain exiting the European Union, or Brexit. The mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, went to Brussels today to ask for a fair deal during Brexit negotiations.
There's no need, as some have suggested, for the EU to send a message or to instill fear by punishing the UK, because a proud, optimistic and confident institution does not secure its future through fear. Quite the opposite.
Joining us now is the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson. He's in London, and we're also joined by Bernd Rigaert, senior European correspondent for Deutsche Welle. He's in Brussels. Welcome to both of you. And Bernd, let me start with you. How is that message from Sadiq Khan being received in Brussels?
Well, there's a mixed mood here in Brussels. On the one hand, many people are sad that Britain is really going to leave. On the other hand, there's a kind of, I can call it revenge feeling or something like that. They want to set an example and to show that it is not so easy to leave the European Union, that you have to pay a price. And in Britain's case, it might be a hefty price. The price tag lies at 60 billion euros today. So it will be a long, long and nasty way, I guess. I think economically, the EU is better off than the British think, and they don't need Great Britain as much as Britain needs access to European markets. Politically speaking, that might be that the European Union will miss Britain for a while. But I think this will not last. This feeling will not last. I was on the summit in Rome on Saturday, and there Britain was not missed. It was not mentioned anymore. So I don't think that there's a lot of pain now that Britain is leaving Europe.
Rob Watson, what do you think when you hear that?
I think it rams home the idea that despite the Brexiteers thinking that this is somehow celebration Independence Day for Britain, that this clearly is going to be the most difficult negotiation that Britain has carried out in peacetime, certainly since the end of the Second World War. And it does seem to me that even though that the Brexiteers and indeed the Theresa May's government is talking up all these kind of advantages and how much Europe needs Britain, I mean, it does seem to me that the EU has the upper hand, if for no other reason, that the two-year clock starts ticking once this Article 50 is triggered. And, of course, it seems to me that it's Britain that needs a deal more than the Europeans.
And how difficult is it going to be for the May government to do these negotiations? Are they going to face constant second-guessing from members of parliament who don't like how things are going?
I think it's going to be a nightmarish task. I mean, I would draw in 3 elements. I mean, first of all, you've got a sense of it there from Bernd at the beginning that there's the feelings of the EU27, and they're mad as hell with Britain. I mean, they're cross with us. Then you've got the domestic politics of the UK, of Britain, of Parliament, and there are plenty of MPs who are very, very worried about what's happening. And then to add in the third element, you've got the friction within the United Kingdom, because let's just remind everyone that Northern Ireland and Scotland, the majority of people voted to remain in the EU, they are not happy at all, and that is putting all stresses and strains on the UK. So who would want to be Theresa May, I venture?
Well, Bernd Rigaert, how do you think the Europeans are going to approach these negotiations?
Well, if you ask who is in favor, who has an advantage in trade negotiations, normally the party which has time, which can be patient, and this time it's the European Union, because the European Union is waiting for Britain. If after 2 years nothing is on the table, the European Union has not so much to lose, but Britain has. So it will be a very, very tough negotiation for the British side, I guess.
And are there worries in Europe that other countries could decide to leave the EU as well if the deal ends up being too good for Britain?
That's one of the tasks or goals, I guess, from this negotiations to set an example, to show other members that might be a little shaky that it is not worth leaving the European Union. And I can't see any member who is really doing that. For example, Poland or Hungary, which are a little bit reluctant on other policy issues, they want to stay in the Union because they know what they are gaining from the Union, a lot of money and a lot of funding, structural funds and so on. The only case that might be dangerous for the European Union as such is if in France the right-wing candidate Marine Le Pen wins the presidency. She wants to leave the European Union, and that could be the end of the Union as we know it.
Rob, back to you. You were speaking earlier about Scotland and Northern Ireland. We know now that Scotland wants another independence vote. Is there a real chance now, because of all of this, that Great Britain is not going to be quite as big as it is right now in a matter of years?
I think the answer to that question is it's become an issue because of Brexit. Now, it doesn't mean that Scotland is going to become independent. It doesn't mean that there will be a united Ireland. And of course, in the case of Scotland, I mean, for an awful lot of people, the idea that you would both leave the United Kingdom and the European Union, that would just seem insanely risky. But the point is that they are in play. And here's the other point, and it's what I was driving at earlier. You think it's difficult enough for Theresa May to negotiate this new global position for Britain, its relationship with the European. Try doing that at the same time as trying to hold the country together and an incredibly persistent nationalist movement in Scotland. I mean, it is an unenviable task.
Rob, you and I have talked many, many times since the Brexit vote, so you won't be surprised to hear that I didn't think it was going to actually happen. All along the way, I thought that they would find some way out and not go ahead with Brexit. Are you surprised at this point that it looks like it's actually happening?
Not really. I mean, I think there's just a powerful magic in that, in a number, 52. It's not quite 52, actually, but the powerful number is the sort of 51.8% or 51.9% who voted to leave. And all of the politicians, and again, it really is worth remembering, I mean, the vast majority of the British establishment, whether that's the politicians, businesses, you name it, they all think that leaving the European Union is the dumbest idea, you know, in a very, very long time. But I think what an awful lot of politicians have thought is there's just not much you can do if the majority of people are voted that way. And you just have to try and make the best of a bad job, as they would say it.
Bernd, what about you? Are you surprised that we've gotten to this point that Brexit is about to be triggered?
Yes, I'm kind of surprised how unreasonable people can be, and because everybody says economically it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense. So it's all about British politics and independence and words like that and nationalism that I can't relate to. And now it's all about limiting the damage on both sides. So that nobody will gain from this, actually, something. The European Union will not be better off, and I guess Britain will not be better off at the end, if all is said and done. And it will take years and years to get to this trade deal. It's not a deal that can be done in these 2 years. They will do it after a transition period, and only then the negotiations will start, and then the European Union has also to ratify this new treaty. All 27 member states and even some Belgian parliaments have to do that. So it's not a done deal, it's years ahead.
And in some ways, this has been kind of coming for a long time, and it's important for everyone to know, and maybe Americans will understand this better. You know, Britain's attitude to the European Union has always been very different to the Continentals. You know, we haven't been invaded, we haven't been damaged by war or kind of upheaval in the way that continental Europe has. So for us, The EU was never that kind of incredibly important symbol of the end of war and conflict in Europe. For Britain, it's always been a more of a transactional arrangement. It's always been more about the economy. But what has happened in recent years, and I think why this has become a problem, is that Britain had never really liked the idea of a United States of Europe. And even though Britain had all sorts of opt-outs from that, we don't use the currency. And then, of course, the other issue was just the huge explosion in numbers of people coming from the European Union to work from 2004 onwards in Britain, which, of course, has been great for the economy. But just the sort of sheer scale of it has unsettled large parts of the country. So we are where we are.
That's the BBC's Rob Watson in London. We've also been speaking with Bernd Rigaert of Deutsche Welle in Brussels. A big day for Brexit tomorrow. That's when British Prime Minister Theresa May is going to trigger Article 50 and officially start the process of Britain exiting the European Union. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Former President Barack Obama called the Chesapeake Bay a national treasure. In a 2009 executive order, he helped launch a massive cleanup effort orchestrated by the EPA. Well, now that restoration and others just like it around the country may be on hold. President Trump's budget blueprint would eliminate funding for the Chesapeake and other regional cleanup programs. Jacob Fenstam from Here and Now contributor WAMU looks at what may be ahead for the country's largest estuary.
We are in Mill Stream, which is a small feeder creek of the Corsica River here on the eastern shore in Centerville, Maryland.
Chris Dollar is a fishing outfitter and outdoor writer. He takes people on fishing trips by kayak in and around the Chesapeake. During his 20 years in business, he's seen improvement in the bay's health. For one thing, the resurgence of striped bass or rockfish.
And that's been incredible to be a part of. And of course, you know, part of the way I make a living is putting people on them. I mean, they're iconic fish.
The number of rockfish in the bay has increased tenfold since the 1980s. Another iconic Chesapeake creature is making a comeback, too. Blue crabs have nearly doubled in number since 2014. And the most recent report card from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation gave the bay's health its highest grade ever.
So the bay got a C-, and if you've been bringing home Ds, a C- is looking pretty good.
This is Beth McGee, one of the people in charge of grading the bay at the foundation. The bay cleanup got started 34 years ago, back when the Chesapeake was so polluted it was getting close to unrestorable. But year after year, throughout the 80s and 90s, states missed pollution targets. Finally, in 2010, the Environmental Protection Agency set enforceable pollution limits, that is, pollution limits with teeth that the agency can enforce by withholding grants or permits.
There's definitely signs that what we're doing is working.
But the cleanup has been controversial. This so-called pollution diet is the largest ever undertaken by the EPA, spanning six states plus Washington, D.C., a watershed covering 64,000 square miles. To many conservatives, it's a federal overreach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pruitt,
good morning
to the committee.
Scott Pruitt, President Trump's pick to head the EPA, is among those who've criticized the cleanup. In his old job as Attorney General of Oklahoma, Pruitt supported a lawsuit against the Chesapeake cleanup. But at his Senate confirmation hearing in January, he was asked about this by Democrat Ben Cardin of Maryland.
Will you support the federal role in the Chesapeake Bay program?
Pruitt said he would commit to enforcing the Chesapeake pollution limits.
I can commit to you that, in fact, I will do so.
And to funding the cleanup.
I would commit to you in that regard that I would do so with respect to the Chesapeake Bay.
Just weeks later, the White House budget blueprint slashed funding for the Chesapeake from $73 million to zero. Other regional programs like the Great Lakes Restoration would also be zeroed out, a total cut of $427 million. And that could be a huge setback for these programs. Jeff Corbin was the EPA's Chesapeake czar under President Obama.
A worst case, you know, nuclear scenario here is that the states were going to say, well, if the federal government's not on board anymore, then we're not on board anymore, and we're just going to wait this out and see what happens.
He says that probably wouldn't happen. Even if the president's budget did become reality, the states would likely try to keep the restoration going.
Will they continue to make the same level of progress? Absolutely not.
The bay cleanup is difficult and expensive because it's so wide-ranging. The EPA funds projects from retrofitting urban sewer systems to programs that pay farmers to farm differently.
I mean, the field that we're working across now As you can see, almost all of it has cover on it, whether it's green or the brown residue from last year.
Chip Bowling is showing me around his farm in southern Maryland, just a few miles from the Potomac River and the Chesapeake Bay. There's a stubbly mulch on the field we're walking on, the result of planting cover crops in the winter. It's one of several conservation practices he gets paid to do through the Chesapeake cleanup.
And you can see the soil is firm, and there is no soil erosion at all.
Bowling is chairman of the National Corn Growers Association, one of many farm groups that joined the lawsuit against the Chesapeake Bay cleanup. While some farm practices are voluntary under the cleanup, others are mandatory, and Bowling has mixed feelings about that.
The Chesapeake Bay mandate has made me a better farmer because I had to be, but I also wanted to be. So I think a mandate, quite frankly, was a wrong way to go about it, but it made farmers change their habits.
He doesn't support cutting funding for the Chesapeake Bay program, but he is optimistic about EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt.
He knows we have to have regulation. He wants common sense regulation that's good for business. So that's what we want.
It's still too early to know what will happen with the EPA's funding for the Chesapeake Bay program, but former Bay Czar Jeff Corbin says he's optimistic the budget numbers will go up. He says President Trump is a businessman and should see the value in investing in the Chesapeake.
We know that clean water is worth a heck of a lot more than dirty water.
The budget still has to go through Congress, where there is bipartisan support for the cleanup and for its continued funding. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Fenston.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.